Blog Talk Radio.
Friday night, which can only mean one thing. That is right. We are back with the Story Blender, of course, hosted by author Stephen James and Jose Castillo. Today's very special guest, or tonight, actually, very special guest is Zena Del Lowe. You can find out all the information that you want to by going to thestoryblender.com and, of course, suspenseradionetwork.com for more information on this show and every show that we have here on the Suspense Radio Network. So we're going to hop right in right now to the show and kick it off again. This is a Story Blender hosted by Stephen James and Jose Castillo. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. And here we go.
Welcome to the Story Blender. I'm Stephen James.
And I'm Jose Castillo.
And this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling. And this is actually going to be really a fun show and a great show today because our guest has so many different lenses that she can see story through. Zena is a screenwriter, producer, and filmmaker based in Bozeman, Montana. As an actress, she worked successfully in Hollywood for 13 years in theater, indie films, and commercials. She also teaches screenwriting at writers' conferences across the country and has served as an adjunct professor teaching playwriting and screenwriting. Zena, I love how your website also mentions that you're currently writing your novel because you're a glutton for punishment.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Zena Del Lowe, thanks for joining us, and we're looking
thanks
forward
for
to a conversation
me.
Today.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I'm a little intimidated by you because you've actually written a novel, and I just started my first one. But that doesn't mean that I don't know story. I just have been writing in a different medium, and boy, is it different.
Absolutely. No, that's one of the reasons that I wanted to have you on is not only have you written in another medium, but you've taught screenwriting and playwriting. And when we were down in North Carolina, I don't remember where we first met, but I do remember this last time that I saw you in North Carolina, you were teaching, and I remember sitting in the back. I had to leave for some reason. So I got up and left. I can't remember. I had another obligation or meeting or something. And afterwards, people were like, did Stephen walk out on your conference? Steve walked out in the middle when you were talking about it. Is it because he doesn't believe in structure and you were teaching structure? It was pretty funny. And I was like, yes, that's exactly. I don't know if I told you this, but I told them all. Yes, exactly. That's why I walked out. I never want to hear again.
Yeah.
I didn't say that, actually.
No, actually, we have enjoyed that conversation a few times because when I'm teaching screenwriting, I do teach structure pretty heavily.
Yeah.
And there's a reason for that. When you're writing a screenplay, it's a different ball of wax, and you have to understand the Hollywood formula of, I mean, you have 120 pages max. That's it. And even that's too long. You usually want to get a screenplay down to about 100 to 110 pages, 90 pages even, because it's all about timing. And so you don't have the liberties that you can take with a novel. I mean, in the novel, I mean, I'm reading Diana Gabaldon's sixth book in her Outlander series right now. And, I mean, that book is 1,500 pages long. So clearly you don't need to... it's not as much like poetry where you have to stick to a limited amount of words and a limited amount of pages when you're writing a novel. But in a screenplay, you do. And so you have to teach structure at a much more intense level, I guess you might say. However, having said that, you and I have had this conversation because I am such a heavy a structure person, and yet when I'm writing, I have generally in mind a few things I know, but I'm still writing intuitively. I don't write out everything that's going to happen in some sort of outline and then sit down and write. I think that would kill my creativity.
Yeah, there are some people who find that works for them, and it isn't the way I work either, but You know, what I really want to emphasize is not so much practice as how it approached, but the principles of great storytelling, which you know and you've taught, you know, all over the country. And as part of the Act One program, now I don't know that much about it, but maybe you could fill us in a little bit. But I know it has to do with, you know, some of the teaching that you've done over the years.
Sure. So Act One Writing for Hollywood started out as a ministry of an intermission at Hollywood Presbyterian Church in Hollywood.
Huh.
And what it was is it was literally, if we want to impact our culture, we need to train Christians to be good enough to write for mainstream Hollywood. And the only way we can do that is by bringing in professionals who happen to be Christian, who also are professionals writing in mainstream Hollywood. What's interesting, prior to Act One, prior to intermission, I'll say that, there was a very disconnected Christian community in Hollywood. Nobody knew that other people existed. They all thought they were alone. And so then you have a program like Act One come along, and we're actually trying to identify all these people, like people that Dean Battali, who at the time was writing for Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and Cheryl Robinson, who is writing for Charmed, and, you know, so you've got all the, I'm sorry, Cheryl Anderson. You've got Sybil Gardner, who was writing for Judging Amy at the time. They thought they were the only Christians writing for Hollywood. And then we bring them together, and we have them teach our students. So it was a month-long training program specifically dedicated to people of faith to get them excellent, because we are not typically as excellent as we need to be, unfortunately. So that's what that was about. And I had the pleasure of going through the second year of the program, and then Barbara Nicolosi, who was she's just a brilliant woman, who was the director of Act One, she ended up asking me to come on board and be the associate director of the program, and I did that for several years before I left Act One. But it was a great experience, and that's when I started teaching. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I know writing stories that deal with, you know, spirituality and faith, it's like they tend to sort of be preachy or...
Yeah, you think?
Yeah. Agenda-driven, and none of that really intrigues a lot of people. And, you know, I come from the same perspective you do. It's like I want to tell magnificent stories. I want to tell great stories, stories of excellence that, you know, I don't really care what faith someone comes from. They read it and they're like, man, that story was powerful. It impacted me. Instead of saying, oh, well, he had some sort of an agenda or whatever like that. That's not
what
I want.
Well, and you know what? One thing I teach, I absolutely agree. One thing I teach my students, because, you know, obviously, if you're coming from some sort of, and everybody does this, we all have a belief system. We all want to incorporate that, a worldview, into our work. Even Martin Scorsese, he does this. So everybody does it. But I find that the difference between it sounding agenda, message-driven, and just being organic to the work, in my humble opinion, is if you have your characters grappling with questions, rather than coming with answers.
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it absolutely does, you know.
Yeah, so they're not telling the audience, here's the answer to this issue. Rather, they're in the midst of the emotional trial itself, and they're trying to come up with what is the truth in this situation, and then it just doesn't feel preachy.
You know, there was a movie that I saw last year, Clark's 12 Years a Slave, and it was pretty agenda-driven. And honestly, I just didn't like it that much, and I felt bad not liking it because it was getting all of the praise.
Loved it.
And what's that?
Because everybody loved it.
Because everyone was effusive over it. But I was like, there wasn't that moral, I don't know, dilemma. I mean, I kind of knew from the title exactly what the movie was going to be. And I knew slavery was bad, and I felt bad about slavery, and it just didn't draw me in. I felt like, you know, if there was some sort of moral dilemma or question that, you know, they were grappling with, I would have probably identified with the story a lot better.
That's very interesting, and I think absolutely, I think that's true. Did you ever see WALL-E?
Yeah.
Okay, so I think WALL-E is an example of something where it is really walking a pretty thin line between what could constitute agenda message driven and what is just a theme that they're, you know, extrapolating or building on. Because in WALL-E, if they had taken it any further, it couldn't have been any more, you know, conserve the planet, save the planet, or killing the planet, that sort of thing. And
yeah.
Yet, WALL-E, even though that was the backdrop for it, what they had was they didn't have characters then talking about that. They had characters who were engaged in another struggle that was totally different, and so it didn't feel ultimately, I think, message-driven. But it really walked a thin line.
I agree totally. And I think you could see that, you know, with the little storylines running through and the character play between them. And it was funny to see, like, even in talking with my kids after watching it, they were more concerned about what was the interpersonal relationship between WALL-E and the other characters, not necessarily the backdrop of what it was set against. So,
right.
And that, I think, was related to the honest storytelling of people who have needs and desires and want to be loved
right.
And are searching for something.
Right. Yep, I agree.
One of the things when I sat in on the conference, and again, I wasn't able to stay for the whole conference, but when I sat on your workshop, you were mentioning at the beginning of Act 2, people tend to enter a new world or something like that, where there's like this new
sure.
world that they enter. And I thought that was intriguing. So I wondering if you could just comment a little bit about that approach, where whether we decide to do three acts or four acts or however you might structure more or fewer, but this idea that at a certain point in the mid-book or the mid-story that there's this turning of the world where they enter
yeah.
this new world. Yeah.
And I find that this is true, actually, regardless of the genre. I mean, it's obviously more obvious. That's what you call being redundant. But it's more obvious when you have a fantasy world where you literally send somebody to the new world, like so in Chronicles of Narnia or something like that, where you have the characters, here they are in their normal, everyday world, and you spend your first act basically setting up that world, explaining who these characters are, you're showing who they are, hopefully not telling us, but showing us who they are in action, and also establishing the rules of that world doesn't mean necessarily fantastical rules. It might just mean they're not respected at work, and that's one of the rules of that world that you're establishing. But when that inciting incident happens, that event, that launches your character on their journey, whatever that journey might be, they are starting to embark on an adventure that ultimately is going to get them out of their established ordinary world. And by the end of Act 1, we have what I call your Act 1 turning point, which is where they can no longer stay in their current world. They have to. They are literally driven out of it because now there's such new information. They're fully caught up in their adventure. So in What Women Want, that film with Mel Gibson.
Oh, yeah.
You know, okay, so there's a lot of stuff we're setting up in, and I'm not saying that this is a brilliant film, by the way. It's just a good teachable, it's something, it's easy to teach from it. So in that film, you have a lot you're setting up about who this guy is. He's a womanizer. He takes advantage of women. He's the, you know, the cocky guy who all the guys want to be like because, man, he has the moves with these women and all these things. And you also set up how he is at his work. He's kind of lazy in some regards. He thinks he's just a shoo-in for this promotion, blah, blah, blah. Then, and so those are the rules you're establishing. That's his ordinary, everyday world. We meet his best friends. We meet his boss. We meet, you know, the girl that ultimately is going to be his love interest. We meet all those people, but he's in his ordinary world. Well, he goes home. He tries on pantyhose. He falls into the bathtub at the same time that there's some sort of lightning flash or something, struck by lightning. And all of a sudden, the man can hear women's voices. So then when you go back to his work now you're officially in Act Two. It's all the same location. We didn't go to a new actual world. So it's the same set, and yet it's a new world because he's experiencing that world entirely differently. Now he's noticing the wallflower who's not saying anything, and in real life, but in her head, she's talking about when she's going to kill herself, and he is drawn into that. Now he's hearing, you know, what the women are thinking and feeling and all these things, and so it's a new experience. It's totally new. It's a new world. He's no longer in his ordinary, you know, the comfort, the thing he knew, the thing he was familiar with. It's completely transformed for him. So that's what I talk about. It doesn't matter what genre it is always that way because of whatever has happened in Act One. By the end of Act One, it's even their normal world, they're experiencing it differently, so it's a new world. Does that make sense?
So, yeah, so when you're working with, say, aspiring authors, novelists, or screenwriters, do you have them try to think through, okay, so here's my character, here's how the world can change and shift? Do you think that's helpful at the beginning, or what would you say would be the route that you'd suggest for authors to take? A lot of people listening, you know, are authors or suspense writers and suspense lovers, and I was trying to think when you said that about some of my books, and I was like, I can't really figure out, because I've never approached a book like that. You know, I've never thought, oh, okay, at the certain act, you know, the world changes and stuff. And I can kind of see it in some of my books, but others I can't quite. So I'm not saying it's not there. I don't know how to, I don't have the framework to see it. So do you suggest people look for that early or as they work on the book to try and find ways to tilt it, to turn that world?
You know, that's a great question. My honest answer, I think it would depend on the genre and the story if you needed to try to pump that up. It might be something that you, when you go through with your rewrite, you start looking at that and go, oh, you know what? I didn't really, their world doesn't change enough. And now you can kind of tweak it. It's almost one of those deals where if you try to think about that too much, you're going to put too much emphasis on that, and the story is not going to be organic. What I have found, like in your case, Stephen, I disagree with you. I think you always have that. You've never thought about it before, but the books of yours that I've read have always included it intuitively. So what I find is that it's always there, even if the writer isn't aware of that. If their story is working, it just is part of it. So I wouldn't encourage people who have never thought like that to now start, you know, totally thinking about that, because, again, if their story is working, it probably is there, and it might just be something they can utilize as they go back to work on rewrites. I would say, if I was going to encourage anybody to focus on anything at the beginning stages of any kind of a novel, it would literally be think about how to make your stuff more visual.
Hmm.
That's the part of craft that I feel like raises any piece of work to just a higher level of art. And what we're mostly deficient in is our visual abilities to actually implement that visually. Does that make sense?
Yeah, how, so let's say I'm a writer, what would you say would be some of the ways to do that, to be able to capture, to catch hold of the visual aspect in the book that I'm working on?
Okay, well, so I used to only teach my classes to, like, screenwriters at these writers' conferences.
Uh-huh.
Until one year, these two gals came in who were writing a novel. And they were partners in this novel. I don't know how you write a novel as a writing partner, but they were. And they'd seen everybody else at the conference. I was the only person they hadn't, so they thought, well, we'll go to hers. And I had, again, I had never actually even tried to teach novelists, and yet they were the ones who convinced me that what I was sharing with them from a film perspective was absolutely what they needed, and I needed to start getting this novelist. So here's what we figured out in when we were talking about this. I teach a class on the seven levels of meaning in film, where most writers typically focus on writing dialogue, and that is their full, that basically is the fullness of what they have to say in terms of meaning, conveying meaning to your audience. And yet there's so much more that can be done. Like in film, you want to think about how you cut things together, like even like, and so in a novel, same thing. At the end of the chapter, if you end on one image and then you start the next chapter on a new image, the juxtaposition of those images actually has meaning. So, for example, if you, in your novel, you have a boy and a girl running through the field, and they're so happy and they're in love, and he's chasing her and they're giggling, and he finally catches her, and they're on the in the hay, and he leans down and he kisses her, you know, all these things. And then you cut from there to smack, you know, a woman cuts off the head of a chicken, and then there's blood spurting out, and the chicken, you know, is convulsing and stuff. That actually has meaning, your audience, because what do we now know about this beautiful little love story?
It's in its death throes, or it's going to be.
Right, or there's a threat to it, yes.
Right.
We don't necessarily know what it is, but there's something eerie here, because the way we're cutting, even between that one scene and the next, conveys another level of meaning. And that is what I mean about visuals. I mean, using that. But see, I never had to say in words, well, we just can't get too invested in this love story because a lot of bad things are about to happen to this couple. Stay tuned. I don't say that. I use my visuals to say that, and the audience loves it because then they get to be involved in reading your clues, your visual clues, and it endows the work with a deeper level of meaning that is more exciting for the audience to participate in. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's great.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And I like the idea of using that the analogy of film and video to help writers when they transition from one scene to another. And speaking of that, one of the things that I found out is that you are one of the 39% of successful people that have actually funded a Kickstarter. And that is a good percentage to be in, because there's a lot of people that try and fail, and I know more and more authors and filmmakers and people are using Kickstarter to fund projects, and I'm just curious how that process went, and because, you know, we're getting, at least I am, a lot of those conversations, people saying, hey, Jose, you know, should I use Kickstarter to fund my book or fund my project or my video or film? And I'm curious about how your process went and is going.
Well, thank you for asking. Actually, I'm going to be frank, I was terrified to use Kickstarter. I was terrified because it's a very public way to fail if you're not successful. And so I have a short film that I wrote and directed, and I went to my producer and we figured out what we thought the budget for this little film was going to be, and he said, well, I think it's probably going to, you know, come to about $7,000 or something like that. So I had some money tucked away, because I typically, when it's a short film, you know, nobody gets their money back. Nobody. I mean, there's just no way to make money back in a short film. There's no distribution program for that. And so I hate to ask people for money on a short because they're making a donation. So I will never ask somebody else to give me money if I'm not willing to put in money myself on my project. You know, put your money where your mouth is. But I ended up, so I had about $2,000 set aside, and so I thought, okay, well, I'll do a Kickstarter for $5,000. And I thought, maybe, you know, how many, if everybody I know gives me $25, I'm not putting anybody, I just hate asking people for money, I'm not putting anybody out. And, you know, I think I could do it. Well, I actually ended up raising $7,500 through Kickstarter, plus I had about $3,500 that people sent me directly that didn't want to give through Kickstarter.
Wow.
And I still used my own money. And so my budget ended up going up to, I mean, I think we're at $13,000 now. And I'm glad because we needed it to do this project right. But it turned out, I mean, I just was so amazed and so blessed by all these people. People that, I mean, some of the people that I thought for sure would give me something didn't. And some of the people I'm like, who is that? Gave me a bunch of money. Like, I, you know, it's amazing to me how people are so generous when it's a project they feel like they can get behind. And
now this,
mine
yeah,
was
and this
kind
was
of
a
controversial
real,
topic.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that. I know it's a real personal topic for you, kind of controversial, but I go ahead and tell us whatever you want to about it or how
sure.
much you want to share. Yeah.
Okay, so. In a nutshell, part of my life story is that I ended up marrying a man who turned out to be gay. And so I was married to him for about 8.5 years. Now, the catch of it was that he knew he struggled with same-sex attraction, and we talked about it, and he was one of those rare people who would never have said, I was born this way. He didn't believe he was. He'd been damaged in high school, and as many of us are. And he felt strongly that it was because of what happened to him in high school that it kind of got his hooks in him, and it was just something he struggled with, but that's not who he really was. And so, of course, if you are in touch with your own sin nature, I think most of us could say, yeah, I was certainly damaged. I had kind of a screwed up background. So I felt that I was uniquely prepared or gifted or whatever you want to say to actually understand that, and that together we were actually perfect for each other. We could help each other through our damage. We could help each other, you know, we could heal each other's wounds. So... unfortunately, that's not how it happened. Now, what prompted me to write this story finally is that over the years, after I got a divorce, finally, after 8.5 years of marriage, I find about every 6 months or so, I get a call from a random woman that I've never met whose husband has just left her for another man. And who has found out about me from a mutual friend who said, you know who you need to talk to is Zena. She will be able to help you through this and understand some things and blah, blah, blah. And so it's actually ended up kind of being a ministry for me where I've had this rare privilege of being able to walk this road with women and try to help them see more clearly, because there's no one for women to really talk to. And there's a lot of shame associated with it. And what I found is that the women in these circumstances were telling themselves the same kind of stuff I was, and those things turned out to be lies.
Hmm.
There was this tendency of us to believe in the power of redemptive love so much so that we actually ignored some, you know, common sense, basic red flags that had we had no faith at all, we would have probably seen way more clearly. But the faith part of it actually kind of screwed us up and made it so that we couldn't see it. So I ultimately wrote the film because I wanted to give the woman a voice. Everybody wants to celebrate the man who has come out of, you know, oh, that poor man who had to live in the closet because society's so cruel, and oh boy, and how great is it that he finally came out. But nobody understands the damage that he has left in his wake and the absolute hell that it causes the woman. It's just, it's a really horrible, painful thing for a woman to be married to a gay man. It's a rejection of everything you are as a woman, and you keep trying to give yourself and you keep getting rejected, and you internalize that, and it's very, very painful. So I simply wanted to write a story that gave the woman a voice, because we just don't see it.
Wow.
Anyway, that's the story.
Yeah. No, it's good. And you're going to be able to get your story out there through the Kickstarter program. And when do you think, or how will people be able to watch your film? Where will it be, on YouTube or a special channel, website?
It will after we've done the film festival circuit.
Oh, okay.
Most film festivals will not even consider your film if it is simultaneously viewable on YouTube, because they want it to be special. They want it so that people actually have to come to your their festival to be able to see your film.
Sure.
So there's typically a year-long life in a festival circuit for a film, and once that's up, then of course it will go on. It will actually probably go on my website, missionranchfilms.com, and I'll probably have it on YouTube too. But people will be able to see it then. But it'll be a while. So hopefully we'll win lots and lots of awards.
I hope so. I hope it does. You have the actually kind of unique perspective. You write, you produce, you act, you direct. You do all of these things in making your films. So you're able to see storytelling from a lot of different angles. A lot of us, it's just not the case, whether we're novelists or screenwriters, whatever, we probably don't have the nexus of all of those perspectives coming together. How does that help to inform you either on your view of story or the stories that you're telling? What are some of the advantages or any tool, or I guess any lessons that you can draw from your past and those perspectives? I love what you said earlier about visual. That was good. Any other stuff like that that would really apply to us where we may never have thought of it before?
Sure. Well, yes, actually, this is interesting. So when I first wrote my little script, I had no idea. I mean, you know, it's pretty dark, and I had no idea. I just needed to tell it, and so I wrote it. And then I gave it to a couple of friends of mine to say, can I even tell this story? And when they were like, yeah, in fact, not only can you, you have to. And I decided, well, I'm going to direct it. I ended up doing a second pass, as the director. And it was an interesting exercise because, you know, I wrote the first one just specifically as a writer. But now that I was going to direct it, it had to change. So I had to have a whole new draft as the director to go through. And one of the things that I found that was part of that process that I think a lot of writers could benefit from is, one, is that in terms of that whole visual thing, it's also endowing objects with meaning. So one of the things that I wanted to do in my film is I wanted to show the slow deterioration of my character, like the breakdown of the female character. And so, but I wanted to do that in a way where I didn't have to say it. I wanted to show it visually. And so at the very beginning of the film, I have her she's always in dresses, and the house is always have fresh flowers, and it's just light and airy, and, you know, even her dresses are very flowy and very sexy, but very, you know, classy, classic kind of thing. And then as the film goes on, we start seeing a shift in what she's wearing or what she's doing with her hair. And then at one point, there's a scene where she's sitting outside of a park in her car. And, you know, in the original draft, I just have her sitting there in the car. And she's looking into the distance or whatever. And as the director, I went back and I was like, okay, how can I continue to show this breakdown? So I had her smoking in the car because, you know, it's the self-destructive behavior that she's engaged in. And then I also, there's a barbecue scene with a bunch of friends or whatever. I had it so that she was, we see a, this moment where she downs the rest of her wine when no one's looking. And so, you know, we just see this kind of progressive, she's self-destructing. And by the end of the piece, she's no longer in dresses. She's wearing sweatpants and she's got no makeup on and she's wearing, you know, just a big old sweatshirt. There's no feminine projection left in her. She's just, she's given up. She's defeated. Although the voiceover isn't necessarily saying that, and that's part of the, I hope, the ironic counterpoint. Anyway, my point being is that I feel like what makes that work is that I never actually tell or say that that's what I'm doing. I literally just found objects or even wardrobe things that I could use to show it without it actually being preachy or hit me over the head with it or beat it. You know, it's like I think it feels organic while also having a very strong emotional impact on your audience. I think that would be true even if you just read it.
I think what you did, you know, is you took note of the character's arc or journey or whatever you want to call it. I mean, whatever terms in vogue today, but you looked at that and then looked for ways to, like what you said, show, don't tell, to show us that journey, to show us the deterioration of her, you know, internally by showing externally kind of the self-destructive stuff. And I think no matter what we're writing, if it's, a novel or screenplay or whatever, getting to know our characters, seeing the trajectory that they're on and finding ways to then show that, I think that's powerful. That's good. Yeah.
Well, and here's just another thing to go along with that. You mentioned the whole thing that I was an actor and all those things. One thing that I always tell my students at Covenant College is I say, always give your character, whether you're writing a novel, a play, or a screenplay, always give your character something to do. You know, so before you even start the scene, figure out what are they doing, because people are always doing something. Even if, like right now, I'm in my backyard and I'm walking in a square around my backyard as we're talking. It's just a beautiful day and I want to be outside as we're talking. But I'm doing something. I'm not just sitting there doing nothing. And most writers tend to not think about the actors actually having to perform the piece, and they tend to have characters that aren't doing anything. And if you have your characters doing something, then whatever it is they're doing gets to inform the scene. So if they're washing dishes and their wife comes in, you know, a man's washing dishes and his wife comes in and she says something to him and he sets that cup on the counter a little harder than maybe he should, but he says, "Yes, dear." Now we get to show through whatever action we've given the characters how they're feeling emotionally without ever telling. And it's a beautiful way. You use the props, you use the doing to magnify and enhance the scene emotionally.
And see, this is good because, a lot of this isn't taught typically to novelists. I mean, I've studied acting a little bit, and this kind of stuff comes up much more in theater and drama and the theater arts and so on. And it's great to remind ourselves, you use your environment, you know, imbue meaning into these objects, and then you can use that to portray, you know, what's going on internally and in the character. And you know what I see so often is characters sitting down and having a meal and just talking or driving around.
Yep.
It's like the reader the writer wants to, like, give information, so they stick them in a car and they drive around and talk about stuff. I'm like, that's not a scene. I mean,
yeah, exactly, exactly. I'm totally with you. And the other thing about that is that when you give the characters something to do, you're actually, it changes how you write, because instead of saying, you know, she felt happy and she thought about the time when her mother was da-da-da-da-da, because she just felt so radiantly happy. Instead, what you tend to do is you start writing more visually. It actually makes your novel more translatable into some sort of film or television medium, because you're necessarily including behavior where the audience just gets to interpret that behavior and conclude that they're happy. So instead of actually writing, which is boring, she was happy. If you wrote something like, she twirled her hair and the corners of her mouth turned up a bit. Okay, so now I get to interpret as my reader, oh, she's happy. And it makes me feel smart, which is always a good thing. And it is also more action-driven instead of, you know, it's just necessarily more interpretable in a different medium, which makes it more fascinating to watch. And you want to be able to see it, you know, in your head. Even if you're reading a novel and it never gets made into a movie, people want to be able to see it in their head, and that's how you do that.
Yeah, now, I have to ask you this, because you love film, I love film. Any movies that you've seen recently that I need to check out, what do you recommend? What's something you've seen that you're like, Steve, this is great storytelling?
Well, of course, you have to see American Sniper, if you haven't already.
I have not yet, but I'm going to. I can't wait to.
Yes. Oh, it's painful. I don't want to say too much. Just, it's a must-see movie, that's all. You know, I've seen a lot of bad ones lately, I feel like. Things that I had hoped would be good and turned out to not be. American Sniper was not one of those. It was excellent. I still love Lars and the Real Girl. Love it. I love About Schmidt. Absolutely love that film.
No, I haven't seen that
one. Oh, gosh, you have to see it. It's probably one of my favorite Jack Nicholson films of all time. He plays a totally different type character, but it's a brilliant film. Really, truly brilliant. I highly recommend it. And so I still love that. There's just so many.
Now, when I was in your
classics.
Yeah, when I was in your seminar, you were talking about Witness, the Harrison Ford movie from back in the day. And you were using that as an example of some of these principles as far as structuring your story. And I thought that was pretty interesting, and how I remember that you were mentioning how in the early scenes you see the boy who ends up being, I don't know, I guess he's sort of the protagonist of the movie, but anyway, you could argue that Harrison Ford is, but anyway, the boy, you see him in the stalls and the bathroom, and he ends up taking action that shows us that he is ingenious, he's kind of intuitive and smart, and we kind of like him. I thought that was pretty fascinating.
Right. Oh, well, thank you. Yeah,
yeah,
I mean, Witness is just a great film to teach from, and I think it's a really strong film, too, though certainly by today's standards, if they were to do it today, it would probably be totally different, because it's kind of slow by today's standards. You know, today's movies tend to move much faster, but
yeah.
I still love that film. And but I wouldn't say it's in, like, my top 20 all-time favorites. It's just a good one to... You know what's a great film that is totally underrated is the Aliens, the first one, and Aliens 2. They are such good films. They're totally underrated.
I like both of them. They're both some of my favorites. It's crazy. And it's kind of interesting that they moved from one genre to another, kind of from horror from the first one to science fiction. You know, with the second one, it was not really – it was some horror, but, you know, it was a different feel. It was, well, different director and different story.
And still so brilliant. In fact, I use that as when I teach about setups and payoffs. Ooh, that's something. You want a little clue of or insight into one of the major skills of any writer, regardless of what medium they write in. It's an ability to create setups and payoff.
Yeah, tell us about
that. Setup. Okay, so when I'm teaching my class on screenwriting, I actually give a lot of examples of bad setups. Setups where you can see it coming a mile away. So in What Lies Beneath, Harrison Ford is the bad guy, and there's this terrible scene where he suddenly appears at work. We've never seen him at work before. He's in a lab coat, and he basically is like shows up, and he's and the guy that's there, the other scientist, is like, well, so let me tell you what I'm discovering today. So yes, we've been giving this mouse this injection, and wouldn't you know it, that he knows what's happening, but he's completely paralyzed. Oh, really? And so, I mean, it's just like, I literally, when I saw that, I groaned out loud in the theater. I was like, ah, because you know that somebody is going to get injected with this stuff. They're going to know what's going on, but they're going to be completely paralyzed. It is such a horrible setup that you see it coming a mile away. Or you have setups that are so poorly done that it just rings so untrue. So like in the second, and I love Jurassic Park, the first one is just it's a great film, but the second one is so horrible. You know, they take Jeff Goldblum, they make him the lead character because he stole the first show, but all of a sudden at the beginning of the film, he's got this son. We don't even know where his son comes from. I mean, he was pursuing the other scientist, Ellie, in the first one, but now all of a sudden he has this son who's older. And this son comes home and is like, well, I didn't make gymnastics. I just can't believe I didn't make just gymnastics. This is terrible. And then Jeff Goldblum's like, oh, that's too bad. Hey, we're going to Jurassic Park. So the next thing you know, we're at Jurassic Park, and somehow this kid ends up getting in these containers with, of course, two velociraptors. And what does he do? Well, he grabs the rail, woof, 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 twist, 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 backflip, flip, gets out, slams the door, oh, and he closes the velociraptors in the containers. It is so bad because you just don't believe it. There's nothing about it that makes you go, oh, that was, boy, that's, he sure is good at gymnastics. Now, he said he didn't get on the gymnastics. I don't know why. He was good. I mean, it's just ridiculous. So a great film for setups and payoffs, of course, would be like the whole series of Back to the Future. They're paying off things in the third one that they set up in the first one. But I use Aliens, too, to really drive this point home to my students, because in Aliens 2, there is a perfect example of a great setup and a payoff that you don't see coming. And here's why. You don't see it coming because when the setup is used, it actually accomplishes something emotionally in that scene. So you don't feel like it's a setup. So what I mean is, in Aliens 2, you know, nobody has believed Sigourney Weaver that she got attacked. She's the sole survivor or whatever. She's lost her job as being, on the flight crew or anything. So here she is. She's kind of lost her life. And now the government has lost contact with all the colonists on this planet. And so they come to Sigourney realizing, hey, maybe she was telling the truth and there's an alien on that planet. And if there is, she's the only one who has seen this thing. We need her as a consultant. So the government comes to her to try to get her to go with this group of Marines that they're going to send in there, and they want her help. And so while that scene is unfolding, she doesn't want to have anything to do with them. And then all of a sudden, Paul, was it Reiser, who's the government guy, I understand you're working as a loader. And she says, yeah, so? He says, hey, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, you know, besides, I know it's the only thing you can get. And then there's this moment where it's clearly full of tension, and he says, what if I could get your flight status reinstated? And that then is what persuades her ultimately to say yes, because she is a loser. She's working as a loader. Now, what we don't know is that the whole thing about working as a loader has been a setup, because how it was used in the scene actually paid off right then. It actually accomplished something emotionally, arc-wise, in
right.
the scene itself. It was the manipulation that he used to be able to get her and convince her to come on board. Well, fast forward now to being on the ship, and these Marines are tough as nails, and they call her Snow White because she doesn't fit in. She's weak and all these things. And she comes to the boss guy and says, hey, I kind of feel like a fifth wheel around here. Is there anything I can do? And he says, I don't know. Is there anything you can do? And it's, you know, it's clear that he doesn't think she can. And so she, there's this pause, and she says, well, I can drive that loader over there, or I can operate that loader over there. And he says, be my guest. But he clearly doesn't believe that she can. So now we take this whole time where we very patiently, we see her put her feet in these things and this huge piece of equipment that's like Transformers, you know, back before the Transformers. And then she works this loader, and she gets this big old thing that's super heavy, and she says, where do you want it? And the boss and the future love interest guy, they laugh, and guess what? We don't know that even that's a setup, because it has accomplished something emotionally in the scene. At the beginning of that scene, she was an outsider, not respected. She was Snow White. But at the end of that scene, she finally fits in, she's useful, and they accept her. And so we feel like the whole thing with the loader has already paid off. It's already served its purpose. But then the whole film happens, and now we're at the very end of the movie. That last time when she escapes on the from the planet with the little girl who was the sole survivor of the colony, and you know, the love interest guy who's unconscious, and then this droid guy that she's learned to trust throughout the story. So we're back on the main ship. They've escaped from this planet, and all, and this is the whole story has basically been mom versus mom. Who's going to win? Sigourney becomes the surrogate mother of the little girl that's the survivor, and it's now the queen alien who has all of her children. Who's going to win? Which mother is going to win? And we think that Sigourney has won. But they're back on the ship, and all of a sudden, Queen Bee is back. And she stabs the droid, rips him apart, and Sigourney Weaver tells the little girl, run, run! And then she, her, and when the little girl is hidden, Sigourney Weaver rushes and gets behind this, you know, huge gate thing where the alien can't get her. But now we're like, what is she going to do? What is she going to do? And the little girl is still out there. I mean, yeah, she's under these the floorboards, but that alien's going to get her. What a hell in the world is Sigourney going to fight this queen bee alien? And just as the queen bee is reaching for the little girl and about, and the little girl is screaming, wah! The doors to this warehouse thing open, and out comes Sigourney Weaver, boom, 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 in this loader costume, and she says, get away from her, you blank. And what's wonderful about it is I saw this in the theater, and I'm telling you, when she came out in that loader suit, we had forgotten. We felt that the loader had completely accomplished its goal. We never even thought about it again. And yet, when she came out, the audience exploded, erupted into cheers. It's a movie. It's not theater. And yet the audience was just going crazy. And that is how you do a good setup and payoff. It paid off because we felt it had already accomplished what it was supposed to accomplish in the scenes that it was mentioning before. It was brilliant.
That is fantastic. That's great. Yeah. It's a good place to end, actually, too, is drawing everything together and setting it off, paying it off. I don't think you could have summarized it any better. And it was good storytelling, too, by the way.
Well, thank you. I know it took a little long to get there, but it's
no, it's great. Yeah, it's good, and it's one of my favorite movies, and I've never thought of it in those terms. So that's one of the reasons that I love these kind of conversations, is all of a sudden I see things in a new way, and that's exactly what we want our listeners to take away from this conversation and every one that we do. And so, Zena, what's the best way for fans to keep up to speed on your projects? Is there a website or Facebook?
Yes, my website, and it's actually under construction. I'm getting the logo solidified, but my website should be up within the next about 3 weeks. And so missionranchfilms.com, and then I'm also on Facebook, just Zena Del Lowe.
All right, fantastic.
Love to stay in touch. Hey, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. No,
this
was great. And for info on my work and my novels and my books, it's stephenjames.net.
And you can be on thinkjose.com to find out my latest spicy adventures.
For more about our guests and to check out our other broadcasts, click to thestoryblender.com. And always remember,
the art of the story is all in the blend.
We'll see you next time.